My name is Jana Winchelow. Welcome to this Canadian Opera Company podcast, sponsored by DECA, the opera label. Today, as I often am, I'm with my co-host, Gianmarco Segato. Thank you for joining me this morning,
Gianmarco. You're most welcome.
Today, we're exploring the final opera in the COC's 2010-2011 season, Christoph Willibald Gluck's Orfeo et Euridice. Now, at the start of our podcast, we were listening to the overture, and the recording we're listening today is on the DECA label. This is part of their compact opera collection. John Elliott Gardiner conducts the English Baroque soloists and the Monteverdi Choir. Derek Lee Regan is Orfeo, Sylvia McNair is Euridice, and Cyndia Seddon is Amore. This recording was made in 1993, and it's actually available for purchase at the Opera Shop during performances this spring at the COC for $22.75, including taxes.
It's a bargain. That's the whole opera. Yeah, no, it's a beautiful recording. And where do you start with such a beautiful work as Orfeo? This will be my first time actually hearing the opera live, and it's the first time the COC's performed it, which
That's
is
right.
quite amazing, because it's a seminal work. It's one of these pieces that, when you look at the history of opera, Gluck was really changing things, and we'll talk about that a bit during the podcast.
It's an opera milestone.
It is, yeah. So speaking of our production, we'll be presenting 8 performances this spring from May 8th to the 28th in our wonderful opera house, the Four Seasons Center for the Performing Arts. We have lots of other information about the opera, much more than we can put into this podcast, which you can find online at our website, which is coc.ca. And there you can find an interactive quiz about Orfeo, a listening guide. There are some nice photographs of the production that we're performing. And all the ticket information you need, again, it's on coc.ca. And there you can also find our ever-popular blog, Parlando, which is regularly updated at least 2 times a week with interesting behind-the-scenes information. We have a Facebook page as well where you can comment on anything you want to comment about, I suppose. But we're especially interested in hearing your comments about these podcasts. And if you have any suggestions for future podcasts.
Yes, please let us know.
So today we'll be talking more about the story of the opera, about its fascinating history, and the fact that, as we said, it's an operatic milestone. And of course, we'll discuss our own production. At the start of the opera, Orfeo is grieving the sudden death of his wife, Euridice, who has been bitten by a snake, and will hear shepherds and nymphs gathered with him to mourn. And the chorus sings, "Ah, Euridice, fair shade, if you are hovering around this funeral monument, hear the weeping, the laments and sighs that we sorrowfully address to you. And hear your unhappy husband who laments and calls upon you weeping, as when the loving turtle dove loses his sweet companion." And we'll hear countertenor Derek Lee Regan as Orfeo.
Thank you.
Something that occurred to me when I first heard that piece of music was the vocal lines for Orfeo in the chorus are so lamenting. You can hear the crying in them. Mm-hmm. It's such a perfectly direct message of grief.
Right.
And the words, as when the loving turtle dove loses his sweet companion, I could hear the mourning dove sound in mm-hmm. that. Mm. It's this clear emotion expressed in the opera that marked Orfeo as separate from operas that had come before, and as a turning point in the evolution of the art form. Just to back up a little, so Gluck was born in 1714 in Germany. His father was a forester and was determined that young Gluck would also be a forester, and he didn't want to be. He ran away at the age of 13 to Prague.
Wow.
And he actually built himself a career as a musician. He was mainly self-taught. He worked all over Europe. I mean, it's a remarkable story. At the age of 38, he settled in Vienna, and this was to be his home for the rest of his life, apart from a few stays in Paris. A very important connection he made there was with Count Durazzo, who was a Viennese impresario, and he brought the French opera comique to Vienna, and this was something that Gluck found very intriguing. Through Durazzo, Gluck also met Gasparo Angiolini, who was a choreographer, and Ranieri de Calzabigi, and he was a librettist and ended up being the librettist for Orfeo and other operas. In fact, with the Calzabigi, Gluck would write his three reform operas, as they're called. Orfeo ad Euridice, which premiered 1762, Alceste, 1767, and Paride ed Elena, 1770. So these three gentlemen had a very purposeful task, and that was to reform opera, to move opera away from the traditions of opera seria, which was the Italian tradition of the time, and this was marked by complex plots, highly ornate music, long show-offy arias, often interrupted the movement of a plot. It was there to provide a showcase for the singer's talents. Their move was towards a more opera comique style. It was a focused approach on the drama, and what they wanted was natural expression. They sought what they called a noble simplicity. With simple plots, direct, clearly stated emotions, and arias and ensembles that developed the story. Gluck actually wrote a manifesto for this reform that he published as the preface to the score for Alceste.
It's interesting what you say about him not being necessarily trained the way most composers would have been trained at conservatory. Because when people are looking at his music, something that's often said, I mean, this is just an opinion, but that maybe it lacks a certain sophistication in terms of the actual composition, in terms of the harmonic structure, or, you know, compared to Mozart or something like that. And obviously it's just his own style, but I think, you know, there's probably something just he seemed to have composed from the heart more, or maybe, you know, it wasn't so studied. It's interesting because I hadn't realized that he had actually not really studied composition in such a formal way. One notable aspect of the reform style that Gluck was developing was the way he used recitative, which of course refers to the passages between arias and ensembles that are sung in a rhythm similar to speech. So the way I sometimes think about this is if you compare opera, say, to musicals. In musicals, you have the sung numbers, and then you have the spoken dialogue. But in opera, they usually it's sung as well. And it's more the kind of dialogue that moves the plot along, and the
That's
arias.
A great way to
yeah, and the arias are more about expressing a certain emotion. So what Gluck did in early music, traditionally, the recitative was accompanied by a single instrument, usually by the harpsichord. And this was known as dry recitative, or in the Italian, recitativo secco. Mm-hmm. And what Gluck did was incorporate recitativo accompagnato, which is accompanied recitative. And all that really means is that recitative had a fuller orchestral sort of underpinning. And this gave a more fluid progression to the music, sort of move forward.
But also you don't have the change between harpsichord and orchestra. It's just
right. It's just more of a uniform kind of structure. When the opera premiered in 1762, it was a great success. And the role of Orfeo was written for and sung by a castrato, Gaetano Guadagni. Now, these days we don't have castrati anymore.
Thank goodness.
And so it is usually sung by a contralto, a low-voiced woman, or, as on the recording we're listening to today, and in our production here at the COC, a countertenor. Then in 1774, Gluck revised Orfeo and he wrote it for the French theater with a French libretto, and the title was changed to Orphée et Eurydice, it's just the French version. And this version featured a fuller orchestra and with 30 minutes more music, including the full version of the Dance of the Blessed Spirits, which is one of the most famous orchestral excerpts from the opera. Yes. You often hear that one. And the role of Orfeo was also revised and rewritten to be sung by a very high tenor, and it's very virtuoso version of that role. And if we skip forward, gosh, close to 100 years later, we have Hector Berlioz sort of putting his stamp on the opera, and he cobbled together a version of Gluck's two versions, I guess, the Italian and the French version. Mm-hmm. And that's also been performed and very successful. And I know there's an incredible aria for Orfeo, and it's usually sung by a mezzo, I think, in the Berlioz version, that's very decorated. So in a way, it's almost retrogressive. I mean, Orfeo, I mean, right. Gluck was trying to get away from that kind of folk writing, I think, and I think Berlioz put some of that back in.
Yeah.
And there's also a version for baritone. and this often happens with early music. When you look back at recordings from, say, the 50s and 60s, there's a famous recording, for instance, of Julius Caesar with Beverly Sills, and I think it's Norman Treagle, the bass, who sings Caesar. And now, as time's gone on and we've learned more about authentic performance practice, we tend to prefer countertenors in these roles or mezzo-sopranos.
Closer to the composer's original intent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because I think when you transcribe this sort of thing for baritone, you have to do a lot of changes in terms of the vocal line and key changes and things like this that would take it away from, you know, what the composer originally wanted.
Well, I've never heard a baritone sing it, but apparently two of them that have been Hermann Prey and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau.
Mm-hmm.
Two very, very fine baritones.
Yeah,
it'd be really interesting to listen to them.
I think it's partly just that, you know, the music is just so beautiful that everyone wants to sing it. Everyone wants the chance. Mm-hmm. At the COC this spring, we'll be presenting the original Italian version, and it lasts about an hour and a half with no intermission. Now, as for Gluck, he ended his career with a masterpiece, the opera Iphigenie en Tauride, which premiered in 1779. And it's another fine example of this reform opera, this need he had to take existing forms and sort of concentrate them down to music of pure emotion. And, of course, one of the reasons we mentioned this opera is that it's going to open our fall season here at the COC in a wonderful production with American mezzo-soprano Susan Graham in the title role.
That's going to be such a treat.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her at the Met High Definition broadcast singing it just last month. Apparently she had a cold that day. She was wonderful. It's going to be an absolute joy to hear her sing this very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our other podcasts you can listen to online, previews next season, and you can hear some of the music from Iphigenie. Well, back to the story. Amore, the god of love, comes before Orfeo. Orfeo is still grieving bitterly. Jupiter has been moved by Orfeo's grief and has decreed that he will be allowed to venture into the underworld to bring his wife out. There's one condition, though, and where would a story be without the gods imposing some
mm-hmm.
illogical condition? He cannot look upon his wife until they've left the underworld, and he can't tell her about this condition.
Mm-hmm.
And if he does, that's it. He'll lose it forever. We'll hear Cynthia Seddon as Amore.
Oh,
Orfeo sets out to go to the underworld to retrieve his wife. He's unnerved about the condition of how he can retrieve her, because he knows that he and Eurydice will be overcome with joy about being reunited. Although the opera is performed with no intermission, it is in three acts, and the second act marks a change in location as Orfeo descends into the underworld. Furies and specters are enraged at the presence of a live man in their realm, and we'll hear part of their thrilling chorus now, Chimai del Erebo.